As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, was good.
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you want to level up your marketing and business knowledge, look no further than the Marketing School podcast, hosted by Neil Patel and yours truly, Eric Hsu. It is the number one marketing podcast on Apple and number 15 on business in the United States. Now, if you want to listen to interesting conversations with operators that have been there, done that, also with other interesting guests, then listen to Marketing School every weekday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
You know, Joe, in my household, we're slap dab in the middle of Harry Potter mania.
Oh, right yeah. Now. You've been telling me all about it, dude.
Yeah. We're reading our seven-year-old the books. We're making our way through the movies. And my son applies just an amazing level of focus and determination to all these Harry Potter Lego kits.
Oh, now you got to tell me about those because I love Legos. And I am hoping someday in my life to be able to play with Legos again.
Oh, well, yeah. The Lego kits are pretty great. They're not a sponsor, but I'm just saying they're a lot of fun. The Hogwarts especially is quite a kit. But you know, he also has a stuffed owl, which he has, of course, named Hedwig after Harry Potter's owl.
Uh-huh.
And at the same time, when he goes to bed, my wife and I are currently enjoying the final season of Game of Thrones.
As am I, yeah. And my wife, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so you're current?
Oh, yeah, we're okay. Hooked, yeah.
Yeah, there won't be any spoilers in this episode, but I'm glad that we're on the same wavelength. And you know, and one day I think I'm looking forward to actually finishing reading the books as well once they're all written.
Oh yeah, so are you actually caught up to where the books are in the Song of Ice and Fire series?
I am. I'm caught up and eagerly awaiting the subsequent volumes.
Me too. I've read them all, and now it's been so long. I'm going to have to go back and read them again before the next one comes out.
I know. I'm going to have to hit the Wikipedia entries. So, in the wizarding world of the J.K. Rowling created, the magical community, they use owls to send messages back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And it's beautiful, and it's a subtly magical part of the book, right? Playing on the traditional ideas of witches and wizards having familiars, as well as the very properties of owls that make them seem mystical, right? Their silence, their nocturnal habits, their wise appearance. But in reality, as we'll discuss, no one actually uses an owl to send messages in the real world.
But the more general idea of using birds to send messages is not so magical and not so far-fetched. I guess that's what we're going to be talking about today.
Yeah, and likewise, George R. R. Martin's Song of Ice and Fire books and the HBO TV adaptation Game of Thrones.
Now, folks, if we call the books Game of Thrones today, don't get on our case, okay?
Right.
It's the same thing.
It's just what we've been programmed to do at this point. But in both properties, ravens are the bird of choice for members of the Citadel to relay messages to and from various castles, cities, and important locations.
Yeah, they're the email of Westeros.
Yeah. And you know, it's described in the books that these clever messengers usually only function like real-world messenger pigeons, right? Some are smarter and capable of traveling to multiple locations, but for the most part, you're sending a message from one place to another, right?
Yeah, that's right. Actually, to without any spoilers, to extremely comic effect sometimes in the TV show, especially, mm-hmm. where like seems like somebody will write a message, put it on a raven, send it off, and they get results within like a day when it was supposed to travel 1,000 miles. I'm not quite sure exactly how that happens.
Well, yeah, things have to move a lot faster in the TV series, right?
I think this has led to a lot of memes where like ravens have jetpacks on them and stuff.
Well, and then they also have, I believe there's an additional separate species, a white raven, that's used by the Citadel for particularly important messages.
Hmm. I don't recall that, but there's a lot of detail in the books that didn't even stick.
I've had a lot of time with Game of Thrones to forget many different details myself. But, you know, I think all this works nicely in the books and the TV series because it puts an alternative of universe kind of spin on everything, right? Like in your world, it's a pigeon, but in Westeros, it is a raven. And then, you know, it's kind of like some of the other spins that they do, like having this predominantly polytheistic version of medieval Western culture, some of this alternate, you know, vision of how bloodlines and genetics work.
Though I do think they're interesting, not to turn this into just a Game of Thrones episode, there are some interesting parallels between the religions in the Game of Thrones world and the religions of Western Europe. Like, so you originally have these pagan polytheistic religions. But I know George R. R. Martin has commented that the faith of the seven in the books and the TV show mm-hmm. is really an analogy for the Catholic Church,
yes.
even because yeah. it has, you know, even it considers itself a monotheistic religion. It has a Trinity. It has many saints and other figures. And he just said, well, I just went ahead and made them all gods.
Yeah, he did a great job of taking things that were familiar mm-hmm. and tweaking them just a little bit to where they still felt familiar. Like you didn't have to, you know, take a running start at understanding the religious world of Game of Thrones, but it was a little bit different, just a little bit skewed in a way that made it, you know, resonate a little more.
Yeah.
And likewise, the ravens fit perfectly in this, you know, this grim, dark setting because the raven, of course, is a bird that's associated with darkness and carnage.
Yeah.
And so it makes sense that the characters would be using this bird to send their messages as opposed to the peaceful dove or pigeon.
Yeah, pecking bits of flesh from dead bodies on the battlefield is
right.
how the raven is often imagined. But the way the ravens are used in the book, as we've already alluded to, is actually very analogous to real-life uses of messenger pigeons.
That's right. Messenger pigeons, carrier pigeons. This is an actual method that we use and have used for thousands of years to deliver messages across long distances. And it's not like a magically trained pet. It's more of an animal that will dependently return home after you transport it somewhere else and then let it free.
Which is a much less impressive trick, though still impressive.
Yes.
It would be pretty amazing if you could just like send one to another city on command and then it would come back.
Right. It's like imagine doing it with, say, a gorilla from the local zoo.
Uh-huh.
Where you're like, I want to send a message to the zoo where this gorilla lives.
Uh-huh.
Okay, well, I'm going to take one of its gorillas with me when I visit another city. Then I will give the gorilla the message, let the gorilla loose, and the gorilla will, of course, return home, thus delivering the message.
So I guess that's where you get the idea. You may have heard the phrase a homing pigeon.
Right. Yes, it is returning home. So here we are. We're talking about pigeons, we're talking about owls, and we're talking about ravens.
Mm-hmm.
We know that homing pigeons, this has been a subject that numerous podcasts have covered. I know Josh and Chuck covered homing pigeons a while back on their show.
Oh, that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, and so we wanted to discuss them, but we figured this might spice it up a bit to also discuss them in relation to the owls and the ravens of the world of Harry Potter and the world of Westeros. And in doing so, we'll be able to highlight why the pigeon has worked so well for these purposes and why we use the pigeon, and likewise, why we don't actually use ravens and owls. What is it about ravens and owls that would make them ideal for this sort of work? And then also what prevents us from using them for this sort of work? to begin with.
Well, I say let's go pigeon first.
Yeah, let's go. Let's hit reality, and then we'll dip our toes into the fantasy a bit. So first of all, let's consider some of the epic facts from the history of homing pigeons that I think should ground their use in a real world that feels as epic as anything from Westeros.
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, it seems that pigeons were originally domesticated for food in the Middle East and in Europe, much in the same way that the jungle fowl that we now call a chicken was originally domesticated in India and East Asia. So they were domesticated for their meat, for their eggs, mm-hmm. which a pigeon has tiny eggs, but you can't eat them. The pigeon is maybe not as robust as a modern, hormonally enhanced chicken, but it still is edible.
I mean, again, if you've read the Song of Ice and Fire books, one of the common menu items at feasts and stuff is roast squab or stuffed squab. Of mm-hmm. course, squab would be like a young pigeon.
Yeah, and you can still find squab on menus in various places.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when we're talking about homing pigeons, the homing pigeon is technically Columba livia domestica. That's the domestic version of the rock pigeon, which is just Columba livia.
Now, one interesting fact about the common pigeon, the rock pigeon, also known as the rock dove, in their natural habitats, they're cliff dwellers. They tend to live and nest on cliff faces and rock ledges, which probably at least partially explains why they thrive so well in modern urban landscapes full of buildings that function as artificial cliff faces.
That's true.
And I think we talked about this some with our guest Jason Ward, who came on the show once to talk about urban evolution, especially of birds.
Absolutely, a highly successful species. But back before their success was so guaranteed, yeah, they were this this wonderful edible bird
mm-hmm.
that you could stuff in cages pretty easily. And as you might imagine, people were, kept their birds, and they in doing so prohibited them from flying away. And as they traveled around with these birds, then I'm assuming they probably discovered the curious and dependable way that these birds could then return to their home nest across increasingly long distances.
Mm.
And as such, we have been using these pigeons for thousands of years to deliver messages. It is a pretty ancient practice.
Yeah.
But it appears to emerge out of this original domestication for food.
First you eat them, and then you put them to work.
Right. This ultimately we're talking about a very mundane use of the bird, right? We're going to use it for eating, and we're going to use it for delivering messages. But it's also worth noting that pigeons have a sacred significance in many cultures, though we often refer to them in doves in these instances, at least in the English language, right?
But pigeon and dove, it's the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about birds from the family Columbidae, which is doves and pigeons. But, we can think to the roles of, say, doves in Christian symbolism, and even as a kind of a secular symbol of peace, right? Releasing doves, a symbolic act, right? Likewise, we can go all the way back to ancient Sumerian Mesopotamia, where we see the use of the dove as an associated animal of the goddess Inanna.
Ah, we love Inanna on this show. But that's interesting because Inanna has multiple valences. Inanna can be, of course, like a fierce goddess of war who screams death through the rebel lands,
mm-hmm.
or she can be, like a peaceful goddess of fertility. She has kind of both meanings in different contexts, and I wonder which way the dove comes in there. Is it like the way we associate doves with peace, or is it the way that doves can be used to send messages and gather intelligence during war?
Yeah, I mean, as a means of conveying information, it can serve both ends, right? But it does really seem like this, this prior relationship of domestication with the pigeon is ultimately what sets it up for use as the carrier bird.
Mm-hmm.
Earlier people domesticated them, lived with them, and picked up on their abilities. And really the only other bird, think to the other birds that have a legacy of domestication. And in each one, we can try to imagine to what extent they could have actually been used to carry messages. I mean, you have the chicken. It's not going to work. The duck, the goose.
I'm imagining it, though. That's
the carrier chicken, yeah.
The messenger chicken. That would be like a good cartoon.
Well, okay, so the chicken's out. The duck and the goose, I couldn't find any real discussions of this, but, I mean, they are migratory birds.
Yeah.
So it's It sounds possible, but
are they ever domesticated? I don't know. I guess they are sometimes.
Well, yeah, I've seen them. Yeah, listed as birds that we have domesticated in some cases. Likewise, the goose, the guinea fowl, the turkey, canaries, and finches. But of these, the domestication of the chicken, the duck, the goose, and the turkey, those go back thousands of years. But canaries only go back to the 15th century, and the finch to the 18th century.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, to put ourselves back in ancient shoes on this, right? As one presumably picks up on the ability of the pigeon to carry messages, just think of the advantage in a world where message delivery is only as fast as a human or a horse and rider can travel across either open terrain or more likely a series of winding paths or roads.
Yeah, I mean, we take for granted now that we have wired or wireless communication that can send information electronically or whatever. I mean, back then, a message had to be physically taken one way or another. Either you tell it to a person and they go deliver it in person, or it had to be carried by hand.
Yeah, you had to have a runner carrying it or carrying it to the next runner. And then, if you're going from point A to point B, you're probably not able to go in a straight line. But the bird can. The bird can fly, literally as the crow flies.
Yeah. The bird also has the advantage. This is seen sometimes in the Song of Ice and Fire series where, say, if your castle is under siege and no person, no human messenger would likely get by without being captured, a bird probably could get by.
Yeah. The bird can leave a besieged city and go relay a message. They might try and shoot it out of the sky with an arrow, but— that's why you have multiple pigeons, I imagine, or multiple owls or ravens in your fantasy set of treatments.
Birds can also carry messages quickly over water.
That's right.
Humans can't, or I guess maybe could by boat, but—
Yeah, it's easy to sort of focus on the primitive nature of tying a message to an animal and just forget the tremendous freedom of movement that a bird like a pigeon has. And then in terms of speed, with a pigeon, we're talking speeds of like 50 to 60 miles per hour and up to record speeds. And I think this is, when you're really pushing, when you're racing them, you can get into the low 90s. Horses, on the other hand, you're only going to reach the mid-50s, and that's going at full gallop.
Yeah, and that's like a world record for horses.
Yeah,
that's not like a common galloping
speed. That's like
speed.
Really going. And again, the chances of you being able to send a message by horse at top speed, at record speed, in a straight line, like on this magical highway that you've built between Fortress A and Fortress B, it's just not – it doesn't stack up against the power, the message-delivering power of the pigeon. So to give everybody some more ideas about just the history, the legacy of carrier pigeon use, I was looking at The Hallowed History of the Carrier Pigeon by Mary Bloom. This is from the New York Times, 2004. And some of the high points that the author mentioned here, and I believe this was uncovering a museum exhibit about the carrier pigeon, but we have in addition to mythical stories of Inanna and her association with the pigeon or dove. You also have biblical accounts such as Noah releasing doves or pigeons.
Yeah, it was to test whether the floodwaters of the Great Flood had abated. I think it's in Genesis chapter 8 where Noah releases multiple doves or either the same dove multiple times or multiple doves to go out and see if it can land somewhere. At first, it goes out and it can't find anywhere to land and it comes back to him. The second time, it goes out and it brings back a branch.
Huh.
And that means the waters must have receded from somewhere. And the third time it goes out, it just stays gone and never returns.
So
if you love a dove, set it free.
So the ancient Romans used pigeons for chariot races to tell owners how their entries had placed. Genghis Khan established pigeon relay points across Asia and much of Eastern Europe. Charlemagne made pigeon raising the exclusive privilege of nobility. Pigeons were used for military communication well into World War I when the Germans rolled out carrier pigeons with cameras. that were soon replaced by reconnaissance planes. Mm-hmm. By the end of the war, France had mobilized 30,000 pigeons, and they had declared that anyone impeding their flight could be sentenced to death.
There's actually a famous story from World War I, I believe, about a group of Allied soldiers who had come under friendly fire from artillery and only managed to communicate to their allies that, you know, that, like, stop shelling us by accident by the use of a carrier pigeon.
Oh, wow.
It saved many lives.
Pigeons have been used to transport blood samples from remote regions of Britain and France. In eastern India, they were used for communication between remote police outposts. And as of at least last year, at least one of these lines was still in use. The U.S. has used pigeons to spot shipwrecks. Drug traffickers have used pigeons. Seemingly around the world. I was looking up various stories about this, and, you know, I was finding hits from North, South, and Central America, as well as in the Middle East. You know, obviously, you're not going to send, like, an entire brick of hashish up into the air on a pigeon.
But if you want to send a small amount of something, like across a border or policed area,
yeah.
Like, you take a pigeon from its home, attach the drugs to it, and then let it fly home.
Yeah, and that's exactly what some people have done. This is a fun account that my wife shared with me. She was remembering a West Virginia whitewater rafting place from sort of like the pre-digital photo age. Mm-hmm. And they used pigeons. So what they did is, you know, you're going on this whitewater rafting ride, right? And nowadays we just take this for granted, right? You ride some sort of a ride like a roller coaster, and at the end they sell you a picture of yourself enjoying the ride. Mm-hmm. And of course now we do it with just digital photography. But this particular whitewater rapid place, the way they did it is they had a photographer with a long lens up on a hillside where they could get a good shot of the river.
Uh-huh.
They would snap your picture as you were going down the river, and then they would take the film, they would attach it to the homing pigeon, send the pigeon, like, to the end of the river the pickup is. They would develop the film, and then they would sell you the picture. Because, you know, this is a course of, that's when you want to sell the picture, right? You're just getting off the rafting ride, you're excited, like, woo, that was awesome, I didn't die, it was great. And then there's the picture ready to go like magic, and you pay for it.
Now, that probably wasn't even possible until, like, celluloid or acetate film, right? You try to attach a daguerreotype plate to your pigeon. It just doesn't work.
To understand that joke, make sure you listen to our series of episodes on our other podcast, Invention, about the invention of photography.
Those have been a lot of fun. If you're not listening to Invention yet, what are you doing? Go listen.
Yeah, and you can check out the website at inventionpod.com.
Okay, I got one for you. You ever wonder about the origin of the term pigeonhole?
No, I'd never thought about it, but now I am.
Yeah, pigeonhole as a verb, right? Like, mm-hmm. I don't want to be pigeonholed as just another whatever. I don't know exactly how. I guess it means, like, it's sort of like the idea of being typecast, right? I don't want to be pinned down in this kind of narrowly defined space. Well, apparently this expression has a very literal origin in the domestic pigeon raising trade. It comes from when pigeons used to be given, like, individual holes or recesses to nest in. And then after that, it later came to have another definition of, quote, one of a series of small open compartments, as in a desk, cabinet, or the like, used for filing or sorting paper. And so that's like a standard definition, which I think morphed further into the more abstract metaphor of having your person pigeonholed into a narrow slot.
Interesting. Yeah, I'd never thought about it before, but that makes perfect sense.
And that metaphorical definition came about, I think, in the 1860s, in the mid-late 19th century.
All right, so why and how do pigeons carry out these impressive feats of speedy delivery?
Yeah, why them? Why not some other bird?
Yeah.
Why not owls?
Why not owls? Why not ravens? Why not rats? Why not the neighborhood house cat?
And I think you might be able to answer this question two different ways that we can get into more as the episode goes on. But one explanation might be rooted in the sort of innate tendencies or abilities of each of these animals. And another answer might be more rooted in just accidents of history.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Like, we already touched on the fact that the pigeon was domesticated seemingly originally for food.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of like provided the groundwork for further domestic uses of the animal.
Yes, but it is certainly true that pigeons have some very impressive qualities when it comes to navigation and long distance travel.
Right. Their navigational abilities are essentially twofold. So first of all, they have a compass system, and this tells them which direction they're headed in. And the sun, the position of the sun, and the Earth's magnetic field make this possible. But then they also have a map system, which tells them where they are in relation to where they want to go. Now, and it's this ability that is a lot more controversial, that we have sort of competing hypotheses, competing theories about how they're actually working.
So it's not totally settled exactly all of the methods that pigeons have to navigate the way they do and find their way back home.
Right. There's still research ongoing
yeah.
as to what's going on. And complicating all of this is the release site bias. This is when birds go off in the wrong direction at release, leading investigators to ask, well, what's happening in these cases to disrupt their return? What can we learn about the functionality by looking at the disruption events?
Hmm.
And so the basic theories for how the mapping system works are as follows. First, there's the smell theory. So odors carried on the wind allow the pigeons to map their way home. And studies have shown that the atmosphere does contain the necessary olfactory information. And pigeons have been observed to get disoriented when their sense of smell is impaired or when they don't have access to natural winds at their home nest.
Hmm.
And then there's the Earth's magnetic field lines.
So like there is a theory that there's some kind of inherent magnetoreception in the birds.
Right. As Cordula V. Mora and Michael M. Walker pointed out in a 2009 study in the Proceedings of the Royal Society B, Biological Sciences, quote, pigeons may derive spatial information from the magnetic field at the release site that could be used to estimate their current position relative to their loft.
Okay, so this sounds like it might especially help with like initial orientation toward their target destination.
Absolutely. And again, working with that compass system. So these two things working together. Now, there is also a third theory that I ran across, and this one's not as big as the other two, but to just give everyone an idea of some of the alternative ideas that are being explored here. Geophysicist John Hagstrom has this theory that they follow ultra-low frequency sounds back towards their lofts, and that this is why certain areas can confuse them and throw them off. He argues that topographic disruptions and ultrasound account for why some pigeons are thrown off track in known disruption zones, such as in parts of upstate New York. That was the region that Hagstrom was actually looking at and conducting some experiments in.
Mm-hmm.
And homing pigeons, they can hear sounds as low as 0.05 hertz. So they do have they do have impressive hearing.
That's bass.
Yeah. However, it's also been pointed out, particularly I was looking at a National Geographic article, New Theory on How Homing Pigeons Find Home by Jane J. Lee, pointed out that a given pigeon might use either the smell or the magnetic field mapping system. It might just depend on where they're raised, leaning on magnetic fields in some cases, smell in the others, other areas, or perhaps leaning on ultrasound if that is in fact one of the methods at their disposal.
Well, and that would sort of make sense given what we know about our senses that we use for navigation. I mean, it would depend on where you were that you were trying to find your way to, right?
Right.
Like some places it might be good to listen for traffic or something.
Yeah.
If you don't know, if you're like trying to get back to a trafficked area in an otherwise wilderness-like area, or it might make more sense to just look with your eyes and see what kind of place you're going to.
Yeah. I mean, in all of these cases, I keep trying to like put myself in the shoes of the pigeon
mm-hmm.
and imagine somebody like sticking me in a cage, transporting me, say, two counties over, releasing me in the wild and giving me a message to return to my house. And I would probably just die in the woods in those cases. So it's, we look at something like the pigeon, an animal that is not held in high esteem by most people. You know, we think of pigeons, we think of essentially winged rats in the city.
Mm-hmm.
And we may not stop to realize you know, what kind of amazing navigational abilities they have. But they do. The pigeons can do these feats that, that humans would be completely lost to try and replicate.
Do you think the pigeons' internal navigational computer is as annoying as the navigation app on most phones or like, you know, GPS devices?
I would think not, because it's a part of them, right? I mean, the annoying thing about GPS technology is that it is external, and it's something we have to divert attention to, or you know, we drop our phone out of that little cradle or horsing around with it while going down the interstate.
I don't know what brand it was, but there was one I used to interact with fairly. It wasn't mine; it was somebody else's. But it was incredibly passive aggressive. So like anytime you missed a turn, you would almost hear it like get kind of huffy. It would go recalculating.
Yeah, yeah, there are all sorts of weird quirks like that. They've gotten a lot better, but yeah, they still don't feel like a natural instinct by any stretch. Now, obviously, we could spend more time here talking about the navigational abilities of pigeons, and certainly the way that pigeons and other animals, interact with the magnetic field. But we want to take a quick break here. When we come back, we're going to move on to the next animal in this episode. We're going to discuss the owls of Harry Potter, but more specifically, the owls of the real world. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first of its kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to talk about and go through all the things that are sometimes difficult to process alone. We're going to go over how to regulate your emotions, diving deep into holistic personal development, and just building your mindset to have a happier, healthier life. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, right, which is different than empathy, yeah, right?
And basically have conversations that can help us get through this crazy thing we call life.
I already believe in myself. I already see myself. And so when people give me an opportunity, I'm just like, oh, great, you see me too.
We'll laugh together, we'll cry together, and find a way through all of our emotions. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, we'll board it!
Much of the joy you will find on the road comes from the person you share it with.
So you write the books, Gene, and Vlastar on the business. I understand now. It's a wise man marries a wiser woman.
But be careful and choose your travel partner well, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
Get down!
I'm not stupid, Gene. Something is going on, and it's high time you tell me the truth.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Gene, run!
So travel before it's too late. Your money will return, your time won't. And we're all too quickly approaching that final destination.
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, I'm home.
Everyone knows that it's Dad's job to be a bit of a joker.
Sorry I'm late, everyone. There was an accident at the factory. Monty fell into the upholstery machine. Don't worry, though. He's fully recovered.
Good one, Dad.
Did you get the pizza for dinner?
So he likes to keep everyone happy with some dad jokes.
Yep, right here. I had a coupon, and it saved me a lot of dough.
Well, the truth is, Dad is just a fun guy.
Hey, I'm not a mushroom.
Please stop. Where does he get these stupid jokes from?
He listens to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast.
Oh, great. More dad jokes for me.
We've delivered over 15,000 jokes to over 3 million listeners, and man, the postage fees are killing us. Listen to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast every day on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back.
All right, Robert, give it to me straight. What are the chances, the fighting chances of a military force that wants to deliver messages between its ranks by the use of war owls?
Well, it depends if we're talking about muggles or we're talking about members of the wizarding community.
I'm talking about real world here.
Well,
take the pigeons of World War I, replace them with owls. What happens?
The messages don't get delivered, for starters, because I think ultimately an important part of this is, of course, the legacy of using the pigeons.
Yeah.
But the bigger question is, what if there had been no pigeons? What if for some reason early on people had gone the direction of the wizarding community in the Harry Potter novels and had said, let's use owls. Let's not focus on any other animals. Let's focus on this species or this species of owl. Can we use this animal to deliver our messages?
Right. Whether rain or snow or dead of night, will this owl deliver your message?
Right. And I have to say, when we set out to do this episode, my initial suspected answer was going to be, no, they can't. And I suspected that the reason was going to be that owls are dumb.
What?
That owls are like really dumb. Because, and this is pre-research, but I found that multiple bird shows that I go to, you know, bird shows or like wildlife rescue places where they have, say, an owl that can't be re-released into the wild because it has a damaged wing and so it's used for educational purposes. Mm-hmm. Multiple times, the individual caring for the creatures has pointed out that, well, this owl is really dumb. It's just not a smart creature. And so, you know, there are limits on what we can expect from it.
That's strange. I tend to find that people who work directly with animals tend to err on the side of overstating the animal's intelligence.
Well, and I don't mean to speak for every like wildlife rescue individual out there or bird show worker, et cetera. But it stood out to me, and it probably stood out to me because there is this idea of the wise owl.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's firmly established not only in pop culture but in our mythic traditions. The owl was the bird of Athena, the Greek goddess of wisdom. They were thought to see the future, and of course their nocturnal nature and their silent flight made them creatures of occult fascination. The Romans saw them as portents of doom. They fulfill a number of roles among the native peoples of North and South America, ranging from dire omens to actual spirits of the dead.
Mm-hmm.
And in some traditions, the owl is an evil creature. And in other times, it's associated with a goddess, as in Athena's case, or in Welsh mythology, the goddess Blodawed is associated with the owl.
It is not hard at all to imagine how owls could come to occupy a place of like a terrifying spiritual power, because have you ever been out in the woods at night and heard an owl?
Oh, yeah.
It's a cliche now because it's in the movies and all that, but in person, it is freaky.
Yes. Yeah. And then they have enormous eyes, which you can't help but lock eyes with the owl, and it's intimidating to look at them. They're just fascinating, impressive specimens. And in terms of pop culture, who can forget the great owl from The Secret of Nim?
Oh, it's so good.
Yeah. Yeah,
the kind of Wilford Brimley-faced owl. It had some heavy brows and mustache from what I recall, but it also glowing eyes.
Yeah. There are a lot of different types of owls. There's something like 200 species, roughly. They're amazing creatures, and there's somewhere in the neighborhood of 200 different species mm-hmm. of owl. By the way, possibly the largest owl ever to walk the earth, the Cuban giant owl, which stood about 3'7" or 1.1 meters tall and was either flightless or nearly flightless.
What, a giant flightless owl?
Yeah.
So what was it, like a raptor, like run around along the ground and snatch up its prey?
I believe so, yeah. And, you know, could possibly have achieved, you know, very limited flight, much in the same way a chicken may fly.
Wow.
But owls are specialized killers. They're mostly solitary creatures. There's not a lot of social complexity to their brain load. You know, it's more about spotting and perceiving prey and then stealthily swooping down on them and snatching them up.
Mm-hmm.
But I was looking into this more, and I found a book titled The Science of Harry Potter.
Okay.
From 2002 by Roger Highfield. And it's a pretty cool book. Obviously, you know, it's been out for a few years, but
so this would have only been like the earliest Harry Potter books, right?
Right. Not that the use of owls really, you know, changes much in the series. It's pretty stationary. Owls are just how you send messages. But the major reason he says that owls wouldn't be ideal for this sort of work is that most of them are rather sedentary. So they don't migrate, and migratory skills, you know, would be ideal for this sort of messaging work. It's kind of like if you've heard, I know you and I have heard this presented in kind of like a self-defense scenario, mm-hmm. by saying that if someone is looking to, say, rob you on the street,
mm-hmm.
They have I remember the term used was, they have a small office, they have a small work area, and you want to get out of that work area because there's like just a, you know, it's like a pickpocket or a robber is working, mm-hmm. like within like one street worth of area.
Yeah.
And that's the similar case with a lot of predatory organisms. They ultimately have a small zone in which they operate.
Huh.
They operate very well in that zone, but you get out of that zone and you might be in the clear.
Now, that might be a good point about the owls not being migratory and being fairly sedentary. But then again, I believe pigeons are non-migratory, or at least in most cases non-migratory, and yet they have this powerful homing and messaging ability.
And then also, I mean, Highfield does acknowledge that, well, you do have some owls that are migratory. So you have, I think, 2 out of the 5 native UK owl species are migratory in nature and in theory could handle the ranges involved in most Potter World letters. And they have great eyesight, which would be useful as well. So we think of like the ways that these, that a given messenger species would find the places it needs to go. Well, the owl has excellent eyesight. It would be very useful. Now, as for their brain power, he pointed out that there had not been a lot of systematic study of owl brain power.
But this would have been 2002.
Right. But he said, but he also acknowledged that, you know, there had been some work in, you know, looking at the memory of barn owls, specifically by Eric Knudsen at Stanford University. And that research seemed to show that they did have solid working memories. While, on the other hand, some owl species were considered to be, quote, rather dim due to the predatory niche that they depended on. Now, but of course, in all of this, anytime we're talking about animal intelligence,
mm-hmm.
it's always a bit unfair, right? Because ultimately, a given species is as intelligent as it needs to be for what it does.
Right. And, I mean, even given that caveat, I think we have learned a lot more about bird intelligence just in the past couple decades than we knew before. Like, it is becoming increasingly clear how smart corvids are, and we'll talk about that when we get to ravens in the next section.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't always know everything we know now about bird intelligence. I think the picture is becoming clearer that the birds are much smarter than we have long thought. Though not every bird is equally more intelligent than we have long thought.
Right. I mean, it ultimately is – a lot is going to depend on what that that particular bird, or in this case, what that owl does. For instance, I was looking around at some actual studies on this. A 2013 study from the International Journal of Comparative Psychology found that the great gray owl, or Strix nebulosa – which
nice.
That's one of my favorites there. That sounds like a spell from Harry Potter. These particular owls didn't do so hot in cognitive ability tests. They said, quote, our results suggest that the owls failed to comprehend the physics underlying the object relationships involved in the task presented. But then again, as pointed out in a 2004 study published in Nature from Levy, Duncan, and Levins, burrowing owls, or Athene cunicularia, which is another nice one, they use dung as a tool, or at least they use dung as bait to attract dung beetles, which are a favored prey.
But you could... Would that be a, like, novel or cognitively discovered behavior, or is that more probably like an instinct?
I don't know, but they were framing it in terms of, you know, this is a, you know, potential tool use that is, you know, and granted, anytime your tool is dung, used as bait, I mean, it's not quite the same as using a, you know, a crafted twig to pull grubs out of a log or something.
Hey, just because it's dung doesn't mean it's not a tool.
Right, yeah. But, I mean, it still works for him. So, I mean, ultimately, Highfield had argued that, well, maybe an owl could be used for such purposes. And I think, you know, based on some of the other research we're looking at, it does seem like the an owl could pull off some of the feats involved.
Well, I think one of the big questions that you would need to ask about whether a bird could be trained as some kind of messenger would be how well do they respond to training?
Right, and to domestication.
Yeah.
I mean, sadly, the popularity of the Harry Potter books and movies reportedly caused an increase in the trafficking of pet owls, which J.K. Rowling has vocally condemned, by the way. Do not go out and try and buy a pet owl just because you like Harry Potter. One of the important cases here is that outside of the magical world or the realm of professional wildlife rescue efforts, owls should not be kept in cages, and they're not going to deliver your mail for you. But more to the point, that handling pigeons is one thing, stuffing them in and out of cages by hand is one thing, but an owl has some pretty vicious talons that can certainly send you to the hospital.
So owls are just generally not good candidates for domestication.
Right, outside of a magical, fantasy series.
Yeah,
it doesn't say, like, the talons alone would give me pause. If you're curious about this, do a Google image search on like owl related injuries, and you'll find some nice swipes and slices here and there.
Dang.
And it'll be enough to make you think, well, yeah, maybe we should leave the owls alone as much as possible.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we will talk about ravens as messengers.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, was booted!
Much of the joy you will find on the road comes from the person you share it with.
So you write the books, Gene. I've lost all on the business. I understand now. It's a wise man who marries a wiser woman.
But be careful and choose your travel partner well, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
Get down!
I'm not stupid, Jean. Something is going on, and it's high time you tell me the truth.
Freeze, Americano!
Jean, run!
So travel before it's too late. Your money will return, your time won't, and we're all too quickly approaching that final destination.
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to talk about and go through all the things that are sometimes difficult to process alone. We're going to go over how to regulate your emotions, diving deep into holistic personal development, and just building your mindset to have a happier, healthier life. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, right, which is different than empathy, right?
And basically have conversations that can help us get through this crazy thing we call life.
I already believe in myself. I already see myself. And so when people give me an opportunity, I'm just like, oh, great, you see me too.
We'll laugh together, we'll cry together, and find a way through all of our emotions. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, I'm home.
Everyone knows that it's Dad's job to be a bit of a joker.
Sorry I'm late, everyone. There was an accident at the factory. Monty fell into the upholstery machine. Don't worry though, he's fully recovered.
Good one, Dad.
Did you get the pizza for dinner?
so he likes to keep everyone happy with some dad jokes.
Yep, right here. I had a coupon, and it saved me a lot of dough.
Well, the truth is, Dad is just a fun guy.
Hey, I'm not a mushroom.
Please stop. Where does he get these stupid jokes from?
He listens to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast.
Oh, great. More dad jokes for me.
We've delivered over 15,000 jokes to over 3 million listeners, and man, the postage fees are killing us. Listen to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast every day on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back. We've talked about real-world homing pigeons. We've talked about the owls of Harry Potter and to what extent the owls of the real world could or could not match up to their to the sort of message delivering service that we see in the Harry Potter novels.
They don't seem like great candidates.
They don't. Yeah, it seems like you're better sticking with the pigeon unless you have the magic to make it possible. So let's turn now to Game of Thrones, to Westeros, and the use of ravens. Why are we not using ravens? And if we really wanted to, could we use ravens to deliver our messages?
This one, I think the prospects are different, but maybe a little bit better than owls. So you mentioned in mythology earlier that you talked about the doves of the Noah story in the book of Genesis. You know, Noah releases doves and eventually they let him know that all the waters are gone from the earth. But don't forget, there's another part of the story that's very strange, doesn't necessarily really seem to add up to anything. But Noah actually sends out a raven first.
Huh.
It's kind of hard to tell what the raven is supposed to be doing in the story. But it starts off by saying, then it came about at the end of 40 days. So it's been, you know, 40 days and 40 nights of raining. At the end of 40 days that Noah opened the window of the ark, which he had made, and he sent out a raven. And it flew here and there until the water was dried up from the earth. And then after that, it just goes straight into the story with the doves. Huh. So that's confusing. I'm not quite sure what's happening there. I do know that there is some there's some theories about the version of the story of the Great Flood that we have that say that it's actually at least two different original stories that have essentially been edited together in the version that we have of the Book of Genesis. So this could reflect different versions of the same story just sort of being stitched together, but I don't know that.
So like one of them is the George R. R. Martin.
Yes, exactly.
And it was never finished, so they had to just like slap it together with this other version of the story.
Yeah, so some other author is like, oh, I don't like the raven. I'm going to do doves, okay? But they also didn't want to throw anything away, so the raven's still there. But yeah, anyway, that's one of those interesting little textual mysteries. But yeah, the question, would ravens be good messenger birds as in Game of Thrones? Now, in the world of George R. R. Martin's Song of Ice and Fire and the TV show Game of Thrones, the people of Westeros, they use ravens mainly to send long-distance messages, like we're talking about, very comparable to the way people have used messenger pigeons. There's a scene where Maester Aemon, the maester, like the sort of learned person at up at the wall, tells Jon Snow, quote, "Doves and pigeons can also be trained to carry messages, though the raven is a stronger flyer, larger, bolder, far more clever, better able to defend itself against hawks." So I think we should keep that in mind, and we'll come back to it later to see whether Maester Aemon's mostly or not on the money there.
Okay.
The first thing we should look at, of course, is whether, in fact, ravens are far more clever. And I think the answer to this is a resounding yes.
Yeah, and this was, I guess, before we went into the research, my suspicion was they might be too clever. Like that and this may be, you know, unfounded bias, but it was like maybe the owl is too dumb. Maybe the raven is too smart, and the pigeon is just this perfect, you know, a mix of skill and navigational ability, but also it's not going to, you know, get bored and curious on the way.
I can totally see why you would think that, but I don't think that's what I would think after the research for this episode. I think that sort of underestimates owls a bit, maybe overestimates pigeons and ravens and the unruliness of intelligence, because it is the case that for many very intelligent animals, it doesn't necessarily manifest as like a surliness and rebelliousness. I mean, often very intelligent animals can respond well to training and conditioning, though often they respond in ways that are unpredictable to you, which is that's an interesting thing we'll get to in a minute about ravens. So ravens are corvids. They're a family of birds containing many other kinds, such as crows, jays, and magpies. Both corvids in general and ravens in particular have, especially in recent years, but for a long time been known to be extremely intelligent. And especially in recent years, we've gotten these studies that show these startling displays of intelligence in lab conditions. And there are tons of examples of this. If you want a whole episode focused on this subject, go back to the one we did a couple years ago called The Unsettling Depths of Bird Intelligence.
Oh, yeah, that was a good one. That we also talked a little mythology in that one. I remember Hugin and Munin.
Oh, yeah, the Norse mythology.
Yeah, they represent ravens. Aspects of what Odin's memory
is. His thoughts and his memory.
Yes.
Yeah, and we also talked about it with Jason Ward when he came on the show.
Yes.
To talk about the birds of the city. But yeah, there are just so many interesting stories about what corvids and ravens in particular can do. Just one recent example I was reading about the intelligence of ravens in particular came from a couple of researchers at Sweden's Lund University named Kan Kabadai and Matthias Osvath, who did a study where they showed really intelligent, interesting forethought, or at least what seems like evidence of it in ravens. So it's already been demonstrated many times that corvids, like crows and ravens, can use tools. And that's one of the hallmarks of complex intelligence, once thought to belong to primates alone. You know, if you go back and look at old textbooks, it's like only humans and the great apes can use tools.
But nowadays, corvids and certain octopi take issue with that.
Oh, yeah, certainly. And one of the interesting things about this to me is that tool using suggests that if you go way back in time, rewind the clock, and just let evolution run out in a different way, if other types of animals with the seeds of tool-using intelligence could have independently developed their own technological civilization the way primates like us did.
Yeah. What sort of world would it be if it was a world of corvid technology?
Raven world. But so, yeah, we know now that corvids like ravens use tools. And this more recent study showed that once ravens had learned that they could use a particular tool to open a box and get a piece of dog kibble, which they absolutely love, they would choose, if they could, to grab that particular box-opening tool and keep it on hand when the food box was not even present, so that they could use it to open the box later whenever it was presented to them, maybe, you know, minutes or hours later. So that's already interesting. Like the bird is recognizing, okay, I can use this tool to get food. I'm going to hang on to the tool even though I can't use it right now.
Yeah, they're thinking ahead.
Also, the same researchers demonstrated evidence that ravens, on average, have a pretty strong ability to delay gratification to get better rewards.
Ah, like as demonstrated in humans with the marshmallow test.
Yeah. So, of course, the classic marshmallow test. Why am I getting a tickle that somehow people have questioned the setting of that test now?
Well, there's certainly been a legacy of reproducing the test and altering the different versions of the test.
Well, I don't remember what that is off the top of my head. Maybe we can revisit that in the future.
Yeah, that would be a fun one. Yeah.
The basic idea is like, you know, if you cannot eat this marshmallow for 5 minutes, you'll get 3 marshmallows or something. And they do a version of that kind of thing with different animals to test their abilities. By and large, animals are terrible at this, just hopeless. You know, they live in the moment. They have impulses. Immediately, if a piece of food is in front of them, they're going to eat it. But in this current group, what the study found is that when you give the ravens a choice between, okay, you can grab an okay piece of food right now, Or you can grab a tool or a bartering token that the ravens have learned can be used to access a better, more delicious piece of food later. One of these experiments showed that ravens will pick the delayed path to better food more than 70% of the time. To be exact, it was 73.8% of the time they'd get the tool or the bartering token that they knew would lead to the better, delicious piece of kibble.
Oh, wow.
And in these experiments, the intelligence of the ravens in question was even sometimes an impediment to controlling the experiment because, for example, I was reading a Motherboard article about their research where they talked about how there was one raven that started building his own tools to defeat the box.
Wow.
And so instead of using the tool they were supplying to the raven, it was like, oh, I can get around this. And so it was like putting together sticks in an arrangement there where it could trigger and open the box without the tool they supplied it. And also that one raven apparently started trying to teach the other ravens how to exploit the box.
Oh, wow.
And neurologically speaking, it's been shown, for example, in a 2016 paper in PNAS by Olkowitz et al., that birds like corvids and some parrots have an enormous number of neurons packed into the forebrain areas. Quote, large parrots and corvids have the same or greater forebrain neuron counts as monkeys with much larger brains. Avian brains thus have the potential to provide much higher cognitive power per unit mass than do mammalian brains. So, you know, mammals, primates like us, we've got bigger brains than birds do. But it seems like birds are really packing in the neuron connections in there to make more with less matter. But there are also really startling examples of social intelligence in corvids like ravens. Like there are stories of how bird trainers who have close relationships with pet ravens can train these ravens to follow and fly ahead of them. There was even video I was watching before we came in here of a BBC Earth segment where they had a raven trainer who had a relationship, a previous existing relationship mm-hmm. with this raven that he'd trained for a long time. And this guy's riding along on the side of a fast-moving truck with the raven just like flying along, chasing after him, trying to land on his arm. So, I mean, that kind of activity, you know, like the raven chasing after him, makes me think, okay, I see potential possibility for like a delivery system involving ravens. It doesn't seem entirely out of the question. You know, I'm just remembering when we did this earlier episode on bird intelligence, one of the things we did was I interviewed one of the researchers who'd worked on a paper that we talked about in that episode on bird intelligence, the researcher Onur Güntürkün.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, I was asking him about the differences in cognitive ability between different bird species. And basically the question of like, have we underestimated all birds? Or is it like just basically corvids and parrots that are smarter than we thought? And he was pretty generous in his estimate of all birds, though, of course, corvids and parrots, he said, you know, essentially there's no major cognitive difference between what they can do and what primates can do. Hmm. So, you know, he's putting them like way up there on the cognitive ladder. Like they're much smarter than we realized for a long time. But even birds like pigeons and chickens, he put more on the level of like mice and rats, which, you know, I think the average person would probably assume that, oh, mice are a lot smarter than pigeons. That's not necessarily true.
Yeah. And then the idea that a chicken is up there as well. I mean, checkmate Werner Herzog.
Yeah, that's right.
Who I believe what he was, Herzog had said that something about there being just this like
the overwhelming yeah. immensity of stupidity in
yes.
the eyes looking back at you from a chicken.
The eyes of a chicken.
I think what he's seeing there is not stupidity. He's seeing like profound ancient magic. That chicken is a dinosaur.
Yeah.
Birds are, again, dinosaurs. They are the avian dinosaurs. They're the dinosaurs that are left. And he is seeing a lineage going back tens of millions of years.
All the way to the jungle. Sorry, some deep cuts on Werner Herzog interviews here, but
can't go too deep. But anyway, I think it is fair to say that ravens are much more strikingly intelligent than pigeons, but also that pigeons are probably more intelligent than people usually give them credit for. One interesting and funny Game of Thrones parallel I came across, there's a scene in the Song of Ice and Fire books where, you know, the three-eyed crow in the books. See, it's called the three-eyed crow in the books and the three-eyed raven in the show.
Okay.
The guy played by Max von Sydow in
oh,
the show.
Oh, yes.
In the books, he's talking to young Bran Stark, which another side note, I just found out the other day that Bran in Welsh, I believe, means raven or means crow.
Nice.
But he's speaking to the character Bran Stark, and he says, "It was the singers who taught the first men to send messages by raven, but in those days the birds would speak the words.
Oh.
The trees remember, but men forget, and so now they write the messages on parchment and tie them around the feet of the birds who have never shared their skin." So I think this is different because he's talking about warging and magical stuff that's
right.
in the books. But he's saying it used to be that you'd like tell the message to the raven and mm-hmm. the raven would go carry the message. And when it got there, it didn't let, you didn't have to take a tag of parchment off its leg. It would just tell you the message. And this actually does have some basis in reality because ravens, much like parrots, can be trained to mimic human sounds like talking, even better than parrots in some cases.
Oh, wow.
And if you don't believe me, look it up. There are videos of this online. Talking ravens. It's creepy. No, it's not creepy. It's gorgeous.
Yeah, well, that's amazing because I would have just have assumed that, you know, this was just a purely magical wrinkle in the world building here. But yeah, the idea that you could on some level train a raven to mimic human language. That's incredible.
I think especially if you bred them for it.
Yeah.
Like the ones best at mimicking human language and talking, you bred them for repeating phrases and you train them individually in their lives. I don't know. I think it's not out of the question. But I don't know of any cases in the real world where there have been like breeding programs to try to bring out like the best talking ravens.
Right. Or even, I mean, I don't even know to what extent that's been done with parrots. I didn't look into that at all.
I wonder. Anyway, a few other things of note. So I was reading about the University of Vienna biologist Matthias Claudia Loretto speaking to the writer Ella Davies for The Guardian in 2017 on the question of ravens as messengers. So they're directly addressing this question from the Game of Thrones show. And so Loretto is a researcher who works with ravens, and he said the following. So he said they're good flyers, maybe not well suited to quickly crossing long distances. Some bird species are already biologically adapted to rapid long-distance migrations. Ravens are not one of them. Basically, everywhere except in the Arctic, ravens are, quote, non-migratory and move rather opportunistically. That said, they can sometimes fly across moderately long distances.
And now I'm trying to think back to my maps of Westeros and exactly what sort of distances we're talking about between, say, the Wall and Winterfell.
I think it's supposed to be pretty far. I think I remember off the top of my head that Westeros is supposed to be roughly the size of the continent of South America.
Okay.
But to mention specifics about ravens' traveling abilities, that researcher I just mentioned, Loretto, and a couple of other researchers published a study in Current Zoology in 2016 that GPS tagged ravens to track their natural movements out in the wild, and they found a maximum movement range for one day of about 160 kilometers. That was the maximum, but this was not common, and it's way less than the daily traveling distance of, say, a car. You know, and a lot of ravens, mostly what they did, the researchers discovered, was they hung around, quote, anthropogenic food sources. That's okay. Not surprising. You know,
like the bodies of the dead that have been put up on pikes by some victorious army.
That absolutely would be an anthropogenic food source. Mm-hmm. I imagine this is more likely kind of a pizza rat scenario.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
But in terms of how fast they traveled, they could be found traveling at speeds of up to 40 kilometers per hour or about 25 miles per hour. So let's see how this matches up against the Maester Aemon quote I read earlier about why ravens are better than pigeons at delivering messages. So compared to the pigeon, Maester Aemon says a raven is a stronger flyer, larger, bolder, far more clever, and better able to defend itself against hawks. So when he says that a raven is a stronger flyer than the pigeon, it's hard to know exactly what he means there. It would depend on what stronger means. But in general, I don't think that's true. If it means faster, that seems to be a no, because the raven's normal top range of traveling speed looks like it's about 40 kilometers an hour. And as we saw earlier, you mentioned the pigeon flies more than double that speed and generally flies a lot farther. Now, if he means by stronger, he means like more acrobatic, that could be true. Ravens do have some kind of – they got some good moves. Mm-hmm. Like, and you can – if you watch Raven flight in slow motion, it can be very cool because they'll do like flips and twists and fly upside down and all kind of strange stuff. Now, in addition to the speed and distance of travel, I haven't seen any indication that ravens have the same kind of long-range navigational abilities that pigeons do. They obviously have some kind of navigational abilities, but I've not seen evidence that theirs has been shown to be of the same power as that of the homing pigeon. So the whole ability to find their way back home from great distance, that may be more unique to the pigeon. Now, the part where he says it's more clever, that's absolutely true. Undoubtedly more clever. But does that matter much in delivering messages? I don't know. How clever does it have to be to just get something from one place to another?
Right. I mean, if they're not actively engaging in spycraft, if they're just taking a message and delivering it without getting snatched up by a hawk from one fortress to another, what do you need?
I will come back to something you just mentioned there, though. Another thing, the raven is generally larger. That is what Maester Raymond says. That is certainly true. But does this matter if it's just delivering a small message written on a piece of paper? I mean, It might be able to carry a heavier load if it needed to deliver something big.
I mean, if you're smuggling Milk of the Poppy around, I guess it might come in handy. But
yes.
But yeah, for just a message, what's that going to matter?
Yeah. He says it's bolder. I don't know exactly what that means, but I think that's probably true. If it means like more aggressive, more likely to approach unfamiliar objects, execute its training, you know, ravens are, I think it fits that they are smart and bold and they'll do what they need to do. When it comes to being better at defending itself against hawks and other predators, I assume, ravens are large. They have very few natural predators, mainly just humans and some of the larger predatory birds, sometimes including hawks. So, I think that probably is right. They are better able to defend themselves. So I think based on what I've read, I want to say that while pigeons are generally preferred and it seems like they naturally, especially when they've been bred this way, fly farther and faster with a message, I don't see any reason why ravens couldn't in principle be trained to become messenger birds, especially if they're bred for that purpose over many years like the pigeons have been. I mean, that's another thing to consider, the domestication program here.
Yeah, again, we have to look at the long-standing traditions that have enabled the carrier pigeon to be the species of choice for delivering small slips of paper.
Right. But then again, while it may be the case that pigeons are more suited for long-range delivery, for multiple reasons, ravens might be more useful on other kinds of long-range jobs. I would say, for example, if you wanted to train an animal to actively do spying or reconnaissance of some kind, like I could imagine that you might be able to train ravens to go into an enemy encampment and recover certain kinds of objects and bring them home to you, probably better than you could train a pigeon to do something like that.
Mm, like if you were to train a raven, like basically where the raven knew that if it found a flash drive,
yes,
it could return that and get a special treat.
Yes.
And then you would just, you know, receive flash drives and hopefully they would have something of interest on them.
Yeah, and I think there are some reports that throughout history, ravens have been rumored to have been considered for like war surveillance and espionage purposes. Mm-hmm. I don't know to what extent they've ever been fully used, especially not to the extent that pigeons have been. But there's your movie setup, Raven James Bond.
You know, I was trying to think of examples of other messenger animals in fiction,
mm-hmm.
and nothing was really coming to mind except for the I didn't read the book series. My wife read the books, but at least the television series, The Magicians,
mm-hmm.
That airs on Sci-Fi. They have these talking rabbits that they'll share, these messenger rabbits. And they'll just sort of pop into existence on, say, your table, and then they'll speak in this this kind of like weird, almost Gilbert Godfrey-ish voice to deliver the message.
Wow.
Yeah. But nobody, it's not, we're not even going to consider the possibility of messenger rabbits here on this podcast.
I think we should consider messenger Sicilians. the like underground amphibians that burrow through the earth until they get to their target, and then they give you the message. And
messenger worms.
It's dirty. It's dirty by the time it arrives. There's some significant slime.
Yeah, well, I wonder if there are any other really fascinating treatments out there. I mean, ultimately, a bird is going to give you the best bang for your buck, right? It's going to be able to fly. It's going to be able to travel in a straight line.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be able to execute a fair amount of reasonable stealth and avoidance of threats.
And they're smarter than we thought.
Yeah, unless I don't know in Waterworld, did they have messenger fish that they used or anything? Even that wouldn't be as good as a messenger bird, though.
No.
Yeah. Messenger rats? I don't know. Well, at any rate, if you're out there listening to this episode, perhaps you have encountered another messenger animal or another variety of messenger bird in fiction, and you'd like to share that with us. Likewise, a lot of people still raise pigeons. I have a friend who just picked up raising carrier pigeons.
Oh, yeah?
So perhaps some of you out there have some expertise with pigeons that you would like to share. Perhaps you have some expertise with owls or ravens you would like to share. You have some insight on the intellect of the raven or the owl or the pigeon. Obviously, we would love to hear from you. In the meantime, if you want to check out more episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, head on over to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's where you'll find all the episodes. You'll find links out to social media accounts. You'll find a link to our store. That's a cool way to support the show. But the best way to support the show is to rate and review us wherever you have the power to do so, and make sure you have subscribed. And hey, make sure you've subscribed to Invention as well. We already talked about it once in the show, but inventionpod.com, that's where you'll find it. But you can also find that podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producers, Alex Williams and Tari Harrison. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you want to level up your marketing and business knowledge, look no further than the Marketing School podcast, hosted by Neil Patel and yours truly, Eric Su. It is the number one marketing podcast on Apple and number 15 on business in the United States. Now, if you want to listen to interesting conversations with operators that have been there, done that, also with other interesting guests, then listen to Marketing School every weekday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene! Gene Fodor!
Gene, what's good?
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right. That's right.